This week our parsha is Tazria and Mitzora. We have a dual reading. The parshiot focus on the laws of tzaras. The Torah tells us there's this white blemish that can appear that is a specific spiritual illness. We have two mitzvot in the Torah, says Maimonides, that are really a spiritual concept in the physical world. One is tzaras. There's no physical explanation to how it works. It appears, it manifests itself in the physical body, but it stems from spiritual sources. And the other is the mitzvah of sota, when a woman is suspected of being unfaithful. So we know the whole procession of the sota water. So those two are mitzvahs that really are not grounded in any logical understanding. The Torah says that this is how it's going to work. The idea of tzaras, so... technically, a guy has a white blemish. He goes to the Kohen looks, he sees the size. There's a minimum size of a gris. A gris is, I don't know what type of bean that is in English. A gris is approximately the size of a penny. That's the size of a gris. That's the minimum size for a person to get tzaras. I'm not sure any of you guys can get tzaras because you don't look Jewish. The Jewish look, the Mishnah says, is the Yemenite Sephardi look. These Germanic colors that we all have, it's not so clear that we can ever get tzaras. So much for being racist against the Sephardim from the Mishnah. It's not clear how that would work with us. The Mishnah discusses it. It's not clear that we have a Jewish enough color to merit to have this mitzvah applied to us. So tzaras is this white blemish the size of a penny. That's a minimum size that appears. Now, the person goes to the Kohen, and the Kohen looks and sees if you have the proper size and if it's the proper color. So we have four colors generally. When it comes to color, we discuss two aspects of color. We discuss the strength of the color and the depth of the color. Meaning the difference would be if I have a glass of milk and I added to it, did I add to it water? Or did I add, did I dilute it by adding water? Or... So if I add water, the whiteness is less strong. And the other example would be, the Gemara gives is if I add wine. But there's a counter example.
Does tzaraas hurt?
It doesn't say it overtly. The commentaries say yes. My brother, who's a doctor, told me that yes. He says if it's anything compared to what he knows about skin diseases, if it's anything like the stuff he knows about, it's very painful. But it doesn't say it overtly in the Torah. Or in the what the Torah does seem to say is that it's contagious, because the Torah says that a person has to distance himself from everyone. He's got to go out of all the camps. He's got to live alone until he cures.
In the sense that if one person has tzaraas and he touches another person physically or something, they'll get it, or like shares a cup, or he'll contaminate him by like causing him to also speak Lashon Hara or something like that.
That's a good question, right?
This makes the whole thing confusing. First of all, it's so often seemingly mistranslated, it's all called leprosy.
Right.
Purely, as much as any other disease is physical, it's physical, it's leprosy. I mean, you know, it's
a, right.
And the other thing, if it would be contagious, yeah, I always thought, you know, a person speaks a lot of Lashon Hara, what's the worst punishment? You got to go out and can't talk to people. But like, the, you know, you can't gossip. But that would, but contagious would totally be, you know, in the sense, unless you say you have a gossip around, he's going to get infect other people like you.
Right. Saying. So the symbol reading, it's hard to know because, again, if you go with the spiritual aspect, so then you'll say it's contagious spiritually. You sit around people that gossip, you end up gossiping. But the Torah does obligate a person to go and live alone. And the Torah does say that anything he touches is defiled. And the Torah does say that he has to walk around like a person in mourning, meaning he wraps his mouth with his talis. He wraps his head. He tears his garments. He looks like a person in mourning. So today we don't wrap our faces when we're in mourning, wrapping like the Arabs do. But in the Talmud's time, that's how a person in mourning would sit. They'd have their garments... Good question. Wait, we'll get there
right.
Slowly. But I'm just saying the idea of tzaraas. The guy gets tzaraas. The Kohen comes and looks at the blemish. If the blemish is the right color, and I don't remember, there are two there's the hue and the depth, and I don't remember. One is when you add drops of water, and the other, I don't remember, is how you dilute the color. The Talmud tells us, the one type of color is like the white of an egg. The other is like the white of snow. The third is like the white of a sheep's cloth. And the final one is like the white of the seed, the plaster that they'd put on the heichal. So those are the four types of white. Now the Kohanim would study, this was one of the traditions they had in knowing the hue and the color. Today we have a remnant of that, not with regards to tzaraas, that we no longer have a tradition on those colors, but we do have a tradition on colors of blood. Meaning one of the things that rabbis study is to understand when they look at a drop of blood to tell, is that blood that comes from the womb? Is that blood that comes from a wound? Is that when certain rabbis who have studied long enough will have that tradition that they can look and see based on the color, based on the hue, based on the depth, based on the shape, based on the way it gets absorbed in a cloth, they can see what where that blood comes from. So the Kohen looks at the blemish, and the Kohen sees if the hairs have turned white as well, and then the Kohen will either declare him tamei on the spot, or the Kohen will say, okay, there aren't enough signs to indicate you're tamei, we have to wait 7 days. You wait 7 days closed off, and after 7 days we'll look again. And after those 7 days again we check, have the hairs turned white? Has the blemish grown? Do we know that he is for sure defiled? Or do we say he's pure? Or do we give him another 7 days? And the maximum is 14 days of closure until it's decided either that he's pure and he should bring his sacrifices and come home, or that he is defiled and he should go out of the camp. He grows his hair long. He tears his garments. He warns, he has warning signs. Anyone that tries to come near him, he says, I'm tummy, stay away from me. He covers himself, as we said, he puts down his covering all the way down to his eyes, and he covers his mouth all the way up to his eyes. He covers his mouth, he covers his breathing. He lives in a hut outside the camp all alone until he becomes pure. And that's how he's going to live now. It's discussed, it's a machlokas in the Talmud, whether his wife is allowed to come with him outside or he's completely alone. Now, so that's the harshest and most discussed type of tzaraas. We have tzaraas in the hair, we have tzaraas in the beard, we have tzaraas in the garment, we have tzaraas in the home. But the type of blemish that's discussed most is the blemish on the body. Now, we have a tradition that tzaraas, mitzora, comes from the word motzi shem ra. Mitzora, one who has tzaraas is because he spoke badly about other people. A person has tzaraas because he was haughty. A person has tzaraas because he wasn't willing to lend his stuff to other people. Those are three causes the Talmud identifies. We had a Jewish king called Uzziah, and he decided to make himself into a god. And he walked into the Holy of Holies, and then tzaraas broke out in his forehead. He had tzaraas for the rest of his life. Tzaraas, it seems from the Tanakh and from the Talmud, is an expression of when a person tries for, sometimes for spiritual heights, that are beyond where he's really holding. So Uzziah walks into the Holy of Holies, so from within comes out this blemish, and he turns totally white. Miriam speaks about, Miriam and Aaron speak improperly about Moshe. They say, hey, he's just like us, why did he leave his wife? We haven't left our spouses. So God says, let's talk. What is God doing? God is giving them a spiritual height, conversation with God, when they haven't been to mikveh yet. They're not on that spiritual level. And what happens right away? Tzaraas comes out on Miriam and Aaron. Aaron and Miriam right away get tzaraas. So tzaraas seems to be something that comes, it's like a pus that comes out on the body when the body cannot handle. So a person either is haughty, he speaks badly about other people, he tries to attain a height that he really doesn't have, or spiritually, he tries to attain a height that he doesn't have, and then this is what comes out. And you'll notice that there are many breaks in time. He's given the time in seclusion before it's decided that he's tamei. Before the Kohen comes to his house to look at his blemish, he sends to summon the Kohen. The Kohen is going to come. What's unique about the Kohen? The Kohen is described in the Navi as Siftei Kohen, the lips of the Kohen, Yishmeru Dat. They're the ones that ensure our tradition. So the Kohen's speech is supposed to be holy. What did this guy do with his speech? He defiled his speech. He spoke badly about other people. What is the prime Kohen? Aaron, who is always busy making peace between people and their friends, between people and their spouses. The Kohen is going to come and declare whether the blemish is pure or impure. We have a very strange halacha here. The Torah says until the Kohen declares that blemish, it is not defiled. Meaning the Kohen's speech is what's going to cause this guy to be defiled. This guy used his speech to hurt other people. So now he's going to call the Kohen who's supposed to use his speech to benefit the people. And the Kohen is going to decide, are you defiled or not? Now sometimes the Kohen comes and sees, hey, he's a chasni, he's supposed to get married tonight. Am I supposed to say, tell me? Machlokas Tanoim in the Mishnah. Whether the Kohen is entitled to say, I don't want to answer you. Come back to me in a week. So that again is very supportive of this idea, like Ari was pointing out, that this is super spiritual. It's not like leprosy. If the idea was that it's physical and he's contagious, so what are you letting him get married for? His poor wife. The fact that the Talmud does have such an opinion that says that the Kohen is entitled to say, I'll get back to you. So that's in a nutshell what I thought we would touch on with the idea of tzaraas. There's a lot to talk about, but I think this covers a lot of basic points. The Talmud tells us in Brachos that tzaraas is like a sacrifice of atonement. And this gives us an insight into a large philosophical question about punishments in general. Why does the Torah punish? You guys probably know there's a big philosophical question. Why should society ever punish? Is it society's vengeance? Is it in order to preempt? You know, it's a preventive measure. If people know that they'll sit in jail for such and such a time, so that'll prevent them from doing certain things. I could tell you, I met a few people who were incarcerated, and they're not normal. People who spent like 2 months in prison, and they never snapped out of it. They snap. Right. So I'm telling you. I
Some
met
of
the
enemies don't do so badly.
Right, that's true. But I met two Jews who were in jail here in Israel, they both lost it after spending a relatively short amount of time. Neither one was incarcerated for years, it gave me a tremendous insight. If once upon a time I thought that prison isn't the nicest thing in the world, but it's not the end of the world. Today I'm not so sure.
The states, it depends which prison, of course. You
could right.
A kosher facility that all good for white collar crime is so fun, but it's not. It's a lot different than Rikers Island,
I don't know. Seeing these guys.
but the other thing is, wasn't Sarat the big hesed in the sense that, you got a warning that this was improper. I mean,
right.
we weren't on the level anymore, so they took it away. It was like a punishment, not to get it. You didn't want to have it, but if you have a society where you have that, that shows.
The Sephorno, it's interesting, in the end of Parshas Tazria, the Sephorno writes a whole treatise. He really writes a special piece about God's plan in creating the world. And in this, it's about four paragraphs long, but he writes about the idea of Hashgacha Pratit, and he insists, this is a machloket in general, does God watch over every individual? And what about the non-Jews? And what about people who are not tzaddikim? So the Rambam learns that that's a machlokas, because we have a medrash that says that even plants, there's a medrash that says every blade of grass has an angel that keeps hitting it and saying, grow. So that medrash seems to say that even the grass, even the vegetation has angels. The Talmud says every individual has an angel. This idea that they say every person has an angel, the Talmud already says it, that we have Malachei Asharet. Right? The Gemara in Shabbos, the Gemara in Tanis, the Gemara tells us in a few places that every individual has angels. So this is we have differing opinions in the Talmud, and the Sephorno wants to say that when a person is on a higher spiritual level, then he has more Ashkecha Pratit. Then Hashem is watching over him more specifically, more individually. Hashem said, I want people to lead super moral lives, and the people that are most fitting for that are the people of Israel. I've given them the Torah. So they will merit Hashgacha Pratit if they live up to it. Says the Sephorno, the majority of the Jews don't live up to it. But when you have a society that the majority do live up to it, so then they were given this kind measure where Hashem says, if one of them, if the individual veers from the path of the masses, where the masses live up to that super moral level, and there's this individual who speaks badly about other people, who does say Lashon Hara, so that individual will get Tzara'at. When the masses, when we aren't on that level, so then what are you going to do? Everyone's going to get Tzara'at. I'm saying, where are we holding today?
Sells newspapers.
Okay.
There's no shame in it.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. It's a worthwhile piece in the Sephorno, if you're curious, just to see his perspective on the job of the Jewish people, on Hashgacha, the type of Hashgacha the nations get, the type of Hashgacha the animals get. In a very short section over there, four paragraphs, he really summarizes a whole philosophical work, is his approach to it all. But if you notice, we have a lot of gaps, meaning you have... the guy notices he has a blemish, he sends to summon the Kohen. What's the idea? The Sforno explains that he and the Kohen will daven. He has a chance. It's like before you go to the doctor. I once had a little bump that kept growing behind my ear. And you know when something like that happens, you tell yourself, oh, it's nothing. And after a week that it doesn't go away, you start asking yourself, is it nothing? And after 2 weeks, where it's like really getting big, then you tell yourself, okay, it's something. And then you don't want to go to the doctor. So I remember going to the doctor and sitting in the waiting room. Now the first thing you want to do is read Tehillim. Suddenly you know you got, you don't know what you're going to hear in 10 minutes. So that's what it was cellulitis, by the way. It's a skin infection, which... after some antibiotics, it went away. But I didn't know that when I went to the doctor. That's the position the Torah wanted the individual to be in. That's why the Torah says you go and summon the Kohen. You send someone to bring the Kohen. That gives him that time in the waiting room to think. That gives the person time to say, well, maybe it's teras and maybe not. Let me daven. Let me look at myself. Now, if he did tshuva during that time, so then by the time the Kohen gets there, hopefully it'll be different. The Kohen also davens on his behalf. The Torah wanted the Kohen en route from his house to the person's house to daven. And here we see the Torah's perspective on a leader's position. I remember about 7, 10 years ago, I have a friend who writes Sfarim. You guys probably saw Sfarim being sold here in the yeshiva, Rav Moshe Harari. So he once had a meeting with Rav Eliashiv, and he asked me to come along. So I said, you have a meeting with Rav Eliashiv? How can I get one? So he said to me, here's the number, call up the secretary, you'll get a meeting. Usually the waiting time is 2 months. I said, are you for real? I could meet with Rav Eliashiv? So he looked at me and he said, what, you think our gedolim, our giants, are there like the president to sit in an Oval Office and be inaccessible? Our gedolim are there to be there for the people. That's why he's the leader of Israel. So that you can get to him. You want him. There's a waiting list, but you could get to him. So that's a phenomenal perspective. The top people in the echelon, if you look at the leaders of Am Yisrael, they're accessible, so long as they can handle it physically. I'm saying there reaches a point where a person's too old. He can't handle it. But so long as they can. So many people got in to see Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Rebbe of Chabad. There's a story, I don't know if it's true, that in the president's office they wanted to know who was the level of importance of different people. So they decided they're going to do an experiment. So they started calling top people throughout the country and asking them that the president wants to meet them when they'd be available. And even the top businessmen were available at a minute's notice. You know, he'll see you... when can he come over? When do you want to come over? You know, on a minute's notice, they were available. They called the Rebbe of Chabad, and the secretary says, I'm sorry, the Rebbe's booked this week, the Rebbe's booked next week. We're going to have to see when we can fit you in. So the president wants to meet with the Rebbe of Chabad, and the Rebbe's busy. I'm sorry, I got people waiting. So I don't know if the story is true, but the idea is he's busy and his job is to be there for the people. So the Kohen, the Kohen's job is not just to come and declare a verdict. You're Tame, you're Taho. The Kohen's job is to stop and think, to pray for the person, and to help the person find his way back. If the person is declared Tame, he goes out and now he's got more time of seclusion. That's it. He's got to close up shop. His business, he's not there to run his business. No cell phones, no faxes, right? So he's out in the hut. And he has a lot of time to think, a lot of time for introspection. It struck me today that this is probably the first form of his bodidus, the Breslover concept of going out into the woods and being with yourself a little bit to get closer to God. Yeah, so that's what the Metzora has to do. And the Kohen visits him periodically to see how he's doing. So again, he's got a Rebbe to teach him. There's another interesting concept, two interesting concepts we learn from Tzaraas. One is that before the Kohen comes to look at a blemish in the house, let's say there's a blemish on the wall. So they go to summon the Kohen, and the Kohen sends word back. He says, before I come, clear the house. The idea is, if I declare it defiled, then everything in the house becomes defiled. So now the guy has to take out all his objects. What do his neighbors see? They see, I wanted to borrow some chairs from you. You said you didn't have extra chairs. How come you have 30 chairs stacked out here? I wanted to borrow your hammer. I see you have two hammers. How come you wouldn't lend me your hammer? So everyone sees everything he owns. But there's another idea here. And that is a concept that is a recurring theme throughout the Torah. HaTorah chasa al mamonam shel Yisrael. That the Torah cares about our assets. That the Torah says, why should he have all his objects defiled? There is this concept, and you'll see it throughout the Torah. In little places, the Torah points out money is important. Yes, we live moral lives. We aspire to be great people as far as our midot. But at the end of the day, money is important. That doesn't mean that we squander our money or we say, who cares if it becomes tamei? And who cares if I have to go out and immerse all my dishes in a mikvah? We do care. And that's part of the attitude that the Torah wanted us to have. So that's why the Torah gave a commandment. It's written black and white in the Torah. They go to invite the Kohen, and the Kohen sends word back and says, make sure you clear the house of all objects before I come, so that they don't all become defiled. So that's concept number one. Concept number two. The Torah says the Kohen looks at the blemish, and then walks outside the house and declares it either Tameh or Tahol. So he's going to walk outside the house and declare the blemish he saw inside the house. Now, we just said that the owner, the man who's suspect of having this blemish, is given time to pray because maybe the blemish will become pure if he does real tshuva. So then who's to say that from the time the Kohen saw that blemish inside the house till the time he walked out of the house and declared it tameh, who's to say it didn't change? So the Talmud asked that question. And the Talmud says this is the source for a halachic concept called chazaka. The halachic concept of chazaka means that we assume that things didn't change unless proven otherwise. So let's take an example. A woman is sitting at home and her husband goes off on a business trip. He's going to come home in a year. He took a ship. He went out to do business overseas. Those days there are no cell phones. No way of communicating. He is a Kohen. So the Torah permits his wife to eat truma because she's married to him. But who's to say he didn't die at sea? Who's to say he didn't drop dead? Everyone dies sometime. So how do you permit her to keep eating truma? And we have this all the time. We have many, many halachot where we make an assumption. And the assumption is that unless proven otherwise, things are status quo. We have a tradition that there are 18 blemishes in an animal that would make her non-kosher. One of them is if in the encasing of the brain, there's a little hole, so then that's called a trefa. We have a tradition that that animal is non-kosher. How come we don't break every animal's skull open and check? Maybe they had a blemish in their brain. Why? Because we say most animals don't, and we rely on chazakah. The assumption is that the animal does not have that blemish. We drink milk. The milk wouldn't be kosher if the animal has a blemish in its lung. Let's say there's a hole in the animal's lung. So then the animal's not kosher and its milk isn't kosher. How do we drink milk? Who told you the animal doesn't have a blemish in its lung? Maybe every animal should undergo an ultrasound. But what about the days of the Talmud? So how do you drink milk? So that's this concept we learn from here. Chazakah is the assumption that until proven otherwise, we assume things haven't changed. And that's a halachic concept that we learn from Tzaraas. Yes?
So why is halak any different then?
So that's a very good question. The Talmud says that there's a high enough percentage, after the Talmud, there's a high enough percentage of animals that have a blemish in their lungs, and the lungs are relatively accessible. So we do check the lungs to check if they have a blemish. And from there, we try to derive what percentage of is a percentage that would obligate us to check. Meaning from that halacha that says you should check the lungs, we can deduct a statistic. What percentage is something I should be worried about? So here the opinions range from 9% to 14%. Meaning there are different in different slaughterhouses throughout the world, the range of animals that had blemishes in their lungs ranged from 9 to 14%. And so there are different opinions what percentage obligates me to check. Because that's derived from there. Yes?
So you think of an animal with that kind of blemish, and they discover it, then how do they go back and see where the milk is gone or the cheese is gone?
That's an excellent question. So our assumption is that there are two things. Number one, we say, if I'd know what milk it has, so then I wouldn't drink it. But now that the milk got mixed into the pool of all the kosher milk, so then that's batel. The other thing is that until this point, the animal had a cheskas kashrus. Chazakah. I don't know when the lung got blemished. Maybe it got blemished a minute ago. Maybe it got blemished an hour ago. Maybe a day ago. So how far back I'll disqualify it. So that's a big discussion in Talmud. The Talmud gives interesting examples. The Talmud says, you come to the local mikveh, and you find that it's missing, meaning it has a minimum volume of 40 saw. It's down to 39. You came to measure it, it's down to 39. How far back do you go and say, all the women who tovel, they have to come back? That's a good question. So that's a discussion in Talmud. There are other examples, but this is a broad subject in Talmud. We're just touching on it. Okay, so that's the concept of chazakah. And now, being that the Torah really begins our parsha with the laws of family purity, with the laws of a woman's defilement after giving birth, etc. So we'll take a few minutes to discuss that. If the tzibur would like that, we'll do a separate recording.